Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Many wrongful convictions are born out of defendants being in the wrong place at the wrong time. In 1997, Christopher Scott was spending a relaxing evening at home with his children when he got a call from a distant acquaintance in distress. Scott ended up driving to the acquaintance's North Dallas home, which just so happened to be on the same street as a duplex where a burglary and sexual assault were committed by two men that very same night. Scott was picked up, identified by one of the victims, convicted, and later eventually exonerated 13 years later, after confessions by two perpetrators who had been hiding in plain sight the whole time. A rarer and arguably trickier type of wrongful conviction can be found in a classic Dr. John tune from 1973.
I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time.
How do you prove that you're innocent of a crime that occurred at the exact place you were supposed to be and at the exact time you were supposed to be there? Or, to put it in Dr. John's terms, how do you prove you were in the right place at the wrong time? That's the question that has plagued another John, John Brookins, for the past 30 years.
I made a huge mistake in my life. A very huge mistake. My decision.
But like in the Christopher Scott case, there might be an alternate suspect who has been hiding in plain sight for all these years in the John Brookins case. And unlike in Christopher Scott's case, there's DNA evidence in John Brookins' case that can confirm his guilt, or as we in the Innocence Project think, prove that he spent 30 years in prison for a crime that he didn't commit.
And welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus John Brookins. This is the first episode in a four-episode series about John Brookins, who was convicted of the 1990 murder of Sheila Ginsburg in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, Adnan Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson, and I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
My name is Maggie Freeling. I'm an investigative journalist, and I'm excited to tell you about my new podcast from the Obsessed Network called Unjust and Unsolved. Each episode tells the story of a person who, I believe, has been wrongfully incarcerated. The Innocence Project gives a conservative estimate that there are over 20,000 innocent people locked away in U.S. prisons. When I learned this, I sent letters to those whose stories haunted me. I heard back from almost everyone. They all wanted to be heard. And so on Unjust and Unsolved, I'm doing just that. I speak with those people, their loved ones, advocates, and lawyers, diving deep into the crimes they were convicted of and presenting the evidence that points away from them. And if it wasn't them, then who was it? Help me search for an answer. You can find Unjust and Unsolved and all Obsessed Network podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now.
In 1964, John Brookins was born in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Situated between Philadelphia and Trenton, New Jersey, the county would later become the location for the M. Night Shyamalan movie, Signs. Growing up, John loved playing sports, fishing in the Delaware River, and being a Boy Scout.
And one of the things I enjoyed was when I was a young fellow was Boy Scouts. I was went to the Salvation Army, and that's where I met my future wife. She was the son of me, a Girl Scout.
John was part of a large African-American family. He was the eighth of 12 children.
Back then, everything was pretty much simple. We had everyone enjoyed each other's company. We ate dinner together. I had a working family. My father worked a full-time job during the day. My mother worked a full-time job at night. And then plus he ran a father and son business would encompass anything from cleaning, stores, just the pieces office, restaurants, or auto mechanics, fixing cars, putting in engines, doing home demolition. My father was the master of all trades, and we all had to learn them.
But one trade that John didn't learn as part of the family business was fixing roofs, and this lack of knowledge is what put him in contact with a biracial woman named Sharon Ginsburg.
Where I met her was I was over my cousin Shirley's house one day, and I was talking about how I gotta get my roof fixed because it's leaky. Got to move a couple beams, and this Dan Lyle was there. He said, "Well, I fix roofs." I said, "Okay." He said, "Let me look at your roof." That's all right. So I told him I had shingles and stuff in the garage and everything. So he came, looked at my roof, and said it wasn't going to cost me too much. So I told him I had shingles in the garage. He went and looked in the garage. And then he said he'll see me in a couple of weeks. So once he looked at my garage, he seen my garage was empty. I just had a pallet of roofing shingles in there. He said, "My stepdaughter is getting kicked out of her apartment. Would you mind putting her stuff in your garage?" He said, "Because I remember your garage is empty." I said, "No problem," like that, right? So he said, "Well, I'll bring you over to introduce you to her." I said, "Okay." So they came over one night, and both of them was drunk. I mean, falling out of the car type drunk.
John Brookins and Sharon Ginsburg struck up an on-again, off-again relationship. In particular, John took a shining to Sharon's son, Ricky, who was in foster care due to Sharon's issues with alcohol and drug abuse.
Just help give him guidance and direction. Try to be a real good, because he had no father figures in his life. So when I would take all the rest of the kids out to like playgrounds and parks and all that, so I would take him with us and take him to see like the boat show. Just take him out for walks, take him out to the playground with the rest of the kids, take him to get ice cream. Maybe your kids stop and just try to stop his mother from whooping on him all the time. And just show him that there's better things in life than just violence and abuse. Because he'll think all his mother did with him is just holler and scream and holler and holler and scream and holler all day, every day. So whenever he had Alan, I try to get my cousin Wendy's kids. I get to take all the kids and just take them with me. We all just go to the playground. Or we just go somewhere and just have some fun. You know, go to McDonald's or Wendy's or something to get something to eat, or go out on a sit on the side of the lake. You know, ducks and all that go by.
Eventually in 1988, John would have his own interaction with drugs that would change his life. But it was a weird one. John was at a check cashing place when he ran into a friend he hadn't seen in a while named Bobby Candera.
He said, "Well, can you get me any drugs?" I said, "No, I can't get any drugs." I said, "But I might know someone that might be able to get it for you," like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I took him over to someone's house. Then we took a ride down Philly. The guy got out the car, went to a building, got the drugs, came back to the car and gave it to Bobby. I took the guy home, and then Bobby took me over to give it to take it to the guy, which I'm thinking, because the whole time he said it was for Phil. So if it wasn't for Phil, the guy who owned this bakery where I got all my free baked goods at. And so we get down by Neshaminy. The guy pulls up. He tells me to pull up in Neshaminy State Park, but it's the swimming pool area. And he tells me to pull up here. And then the guy pulls up on Bobby's side of the car. But then once he gets out the car, he comes, walks around the car and walks to my side of the car instead of walking to Bash's side. So I rose down the window. I said, "How's Phil doing?" He said, "Oh, Phil's doing good," like that, right? So I said, "Phil, no, I'll be coming by to pick up a cheesecake." And the guy asked Bobby, "Oh, you got that stuff for me?" He said, "Like, oh yeah, here you go." So he reached in his back in his front pocket, handed it to me. Then I passed it to him out of the window.
What John Brookins didn't realize was that the man he thought was his friend was a turncoat, and he was working with the police on a reverse sting operation. And because John had handled the drugs, even if just for a moment, he could be prosecuted for trafficking in drugs. John was eventually convicted and served a 2-year sentence in a work furlough program. During his sentence, John remained in contact with both Sharon and her mother, Sheila, who had been born in England and spoke with a British accent.
And then through Sharon, you meet her mother, Sheila. And how would you describe Sheila?
She seemed to be an easygoing person. She seems the one that's best for her grandson. She seemed to be a hardworking woman. Whenever she did the cleaning job she had, and she loved to go dancing. She loved to go to the VFW. She loved to hang out with Agnes, and she liked to drink.
What bonded John and Sheila was their shared affection for Sharon's son and Sheila's grandson, Ricky.
He loved his grandmother. You know, he couldn't wait to get to his grandmother's house. And just, he was just sitting to be with his grandmother. She would just make things nice for him, comfortable for him. She would hug him, kiss him. All the things that his mother refused to do, she was doing for him. You know, you can see that when he's with her, he's smiling. But when he with his grandmother, he's smiling. When she's with his mother, he got a scowl on his face. And everyone can see the difference between the two relationships.
On December 8th, 1990, John Brookins finished serving his sentence after striking up a friendship with a guy in his work release program. The friend's father ran a welding company in Ocean City, New Jersey, and John, through the skills he'd learned in the family business, was able to secure a job that would allow him to start a new life in a new place. Meanwhile, Sheila Ginsburg was about to host her son Barry from Florida, which is where she was thinking of relocating. And so Sheila asked John to come over on Thursday, December 20th, 1990, to help her clean for Barry's arrival and also to celebrate the coming changes in their lives.
During one of our visits, we was actually having a conversation together, you know, because I was on my way to a new job. Sheila was on her way to go down to Florida, thinking about moving down here. And Barry was coming into town. So it's like a celebration thing that we all get ready to do something new and move on with our lives and do something new. So that day was like a celebration for everyone involved because everyone was moving on to do something different.
But it wasn't just John and Sheila who were supposed to meet up at her apartment that day.
I had talked about it during the work release program. We all had a meet. It was between me, Sheila, and Sharon. We talked about the whole thing. We all supposed to meet there early in the day. And that was around 2:30, something 3. So she had called and said she was on her way.
Uh-huh.
Sharon had called and said she was on her way.
But with the sun setting and Sharon still not there, John left to take his friend Rodney Simmons to work.
I don't know, early that I had to go and take Rodney to work.
And so what time approximately do you think you went over to Rodney's place?
I believe it was like 5 o'clock. Because it was dusting.
And then what happens when you get to Rodney's place?
We get there, I talked to his wife, Doris, for a minute. Play with the kids. The kids were still super young then. Then Rodney comes down the steps and says he's not going to work tonight, but come the next morning and pick me up to take me guys my check. I said, okay. So we all, me, him, and Doris talk for a minute, and then Rodney and I step outside. We talk for a minute, go to my car, and then I get in the car and drive back to Sheila's.
And what time do you think you left Rodney's place or arrived back at Sheila's place?
Had to have been like, because it don't take long to get there. So I said I left there probably 6 o'clock, 5 minutes to six, something like that.
After leaving Rodney's place, John Brookins returned to Sheila's apartment complex, the Lakeview Manor Apartments in Bristol, Pennsylvania.
When I got to arrive at Sheila's apartment, I had to drive, have the sign that Norbert Park had was jam-packed with cars. That's where everybody comes to work. So I drove all the way around to the other side of the building. That's where I found the parking spot. Went through the buildings, came in. Did an apartment complex, came into Sheila's building. I knocked on the door once or twice, tried the doorknob, and then walked in. That was one of the normal things when we would leave, when she's expecting company, she would normally leave her door open for people just to, the people that she expected, they just walk in.
According to John Brookins, when he re-entered Sheila's apartment, he came upon something like a scene out of a horror movie, or the life story of Lizzie Borden.
And that's when I seen her daughter standing over, which appeared to be stomping a pair of scissors in her mother's chest, cussing and screaming. I pushed her back, pushed her down, asked her what the hell she's doing. She said the bitch needed to die. Check Sheila for life. I couldn't feel any type of pulse. So I grabbed the phone and remote at the same time, trying to turn the TV down. And as I was calling 911, I looked up and Sharon was gone. Door was wide open. So I panicked. I got afraid of everything that I just witnessed. So instead of completing the call, I hung up the phone and left the house. Went out through the one side of the, I went out the building to look for Sharon. Could not find her. I went to my car, drove through the parking lot, through the apartment complex that I go through. I didn't see her anywhere. So I drove back home.
This is the fundamental question at the heart of the John Brookins case. The state claims that John Brookins brutally murdered Sheila Ginsburg. John Brookins, meanwhile, claims that he returned to Sheila's apartment to see a stunning scene of matricide, and that while his initial instinct was to call the police, he soon found himself as a black man alone with a dead white woman in a mostly white county in Pennsylvania. And so, rather than follow through on his initial instinct, he ran. It's a decision that haunts John Brookins to this day.
I made a huge mistake in my life. A very huge mistake. My decision. I should have stayed. I should have completely made sure to waited for the police. I should have never left. That's the
gotcha.
Worst mistake. Out of my own fear and anxiety. And all the madness that was going on around me, I should have just stayed. I should have just is my ground.
But according to the state, this was no mistake. It was malicious. John Brookins hadn't come upon Sharon Ginsburg murdering her mother in cold blood. It was he who had murdered Sheila Ginsburg. And they had his fingerprints on Sheila's TV remote and phone to prove their case along with one other piece of evidence. Sharon's allegations months later that she had overheard John confessing the crime to a friend. But the state had a problem. Everyone described John as a gentle giant who wouldn't harm a fly. Here's his childhood friend, Eric Reed.
I know for a fact, I feel it in my soul, in my heart, Johnny was never that type of person.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't see him. Now, it was a guy or somebody defending himself, a different story. But a woman, nah, Johnny wasn't. I didn't see him walk away from too many altercations.
Right.
He's one of the guys, you probably have a couple guys that you know through your lifetime. You know what to expect of them. And you know what not to expect of them. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Johnny was, like, predictable. If something happened, Johnny was going the other way.
And it wasn't just John's friends and family. Ricky's foster mother, Betty Marucci, described John as a peaceful and friendly person who always treated Ricky well.
Oh, they were real friendly.
Mm-hmm.
He was real good to Ricky.
Good.
Very good. He would come over here and pick him up in a car and take him back over to the grandmother's,
mm-hmm.
or the mother's, like for a day or a weekend.
Sheila's best friend Agnes Wilkie described John as very nice, shy, and polite, and said that John helped Sheila with her car and would chauffeur her around because she didn't like to drive herself. And then there were glowing letters that John sent to Sheila while serving his sentence. But then, there were those letters. Sheila's murder was brutal. Whoever killed her struck her multiple times with a marble trophy base, manually strangled her, breaking her hyoid bone, and stabbed her several times with a pair of scissors that were left embedded in her chest. How could the state explain the peace-loving John Brookins brutally murdering a woman he so clearly respected and viewed as a friend? Well, again, the letters. The prosecutor would claim that the letters John Brookins wrote to Sheila Ginsburg were evidence of a fatal attraction between the 26-year-old and the 58-year-old mother of the woman he'd been seeing. And so a detective was able to read those letters into evidence, including this one, dated May 12th, 1989.
Be a person who likes virtually everything about life, who is comfortable doing just about anything, and who wastes no time complaining or wishing that things were otherwise. Be enthusiastic about life and want all you can get out of it. Refuse to worry and keep yourself free from the anxiety that accompanies worry. Live now rather than the past or the future. Seek out experiences that are new and unfamiliar to you. Be strikingly independent. Treasure your own freedom from expectations and want those you love to be independent to make their own choices and to live their lives for themselves. Know how to laugh and how to create laughter. Accept yourself without complaint. Appreciate the natural world. Enjoy being outdoors in nature and tripping around all that is unspoiled and original. Have insight into the behavior of others and into yourself too. Never feel threatened. Engage in work that will make other people's lives more pleasant or tolerable. Treat your body well. Be honest. Have little concern with order, organization, or systems in your life. Be creative. Love life and all the activities in it. Be aggressively curious. Search more to learn each and every present moment of your life. Do not be afraid to fail. In fact, welcome it. Do not equate being successful in any enterprise with being successful as a human being. Accept others as they are and work at changing events that you dislike. View all people as human and place no one above yourself in importance. Don't chase after happiness. Live and happiness is your payoff. Your friend with love, I do care, Johnny Brookins. P.S. Thank you for being you. May God bless you.
Another letter from John wished Sheila a happy Mother's Day, and another included a poem. To a jury seeing a large black man at the defense table, the argument that these letters express romantic yearning may have been convincing. But as you get to know John, you learn that this is just how he expresses himself. Colin asked John about how he first got interested in writing poetry and inspirational words.
Teacher back in school, my English teacher, I can't remember her name, she always had different types of sayings, posters posted on the wall. different type metaphor terms or different type analogies on how everything is always different analogies on all the positive aspects of life. Could be the simplest things. Something like, regardless of attitude, the soul is always on its knees in prayer. So that could symbolize everything we do in life. We're going for a job, we're taking a trip, or we're wishing the best for our kids. So whatever we're doing, we're always in prayer, praying that everything goes well. Not just for ourselves, but for everyone in life.
And for his part, John says that his relationship with Sheila was strictly platonic.
It was a friendship relationship where Sheila was trying to help her daughter, trying to help her get off drugs, and trying to help her stop killing herself, trying to help her change her relationship with her son, Ricky, trying to help her change her relationship with the foster parents, you know, trying to be that bridge in between all the madness that was going on in all their lives. You know, that's why she didn't mind the relationship that we had, because I was doing everything. She wasn't used to people trying to help her daughter, help Ricky, assist her in being genuine about it and don't want anything from it. You know?
Regardless of whatever level of affection that John had for Sheila, the state still needed a reason for why he would not only want to harm her, but to mutilate her in a variety of ways and with a variety of weapons. To establish that, the prosecutor used another letter. Not one that John wrote to Sheila, but one that Sheila wrote to John. It stated the following.
Dear John, I have been back since middle of January. Sharon gave me $10, February 23rd, 1989, but no more. I cannot pay your bill, which you owe me, which was $200. You and Sharon did it. You and her have put you wise from now. Know whatever happens with Sharon or anybody else, I will not let my phone bill like it is. I'm very mad at you. My son has gone into a place for drugs and drinking. It cost him $4,000 for 4 weeks, but he does know what he has got, which a lot of people do not know, and Sharon keeps telling me she will go into one of the places. I have called and gave her the phone numbers, but I do not know. Why do you do this to me with my phone bill? I'm not as young as you, and I do not do drugs. John, I thank you for my car, the things you did on it. Please tell Sharon to pay me. I cannot afford $50 every month for phone bill. Signed, Mrs. Ginsburg.
And so, that was the long and short of the state's theory of motive. That Sharon and John had accumulated a $200 phone bill through their calls during a sentence, that Sheila had a foot, and that Sheila wanted to be reimbursed for. It's not clear how exactly this forms a motive for John to maim and murder Sheila, because there's no way she could force him to pay the bill. And indeed, she was merely asking John to get Sharon to pony up for it. And, as defense counsel noted at trial, it's not even clear that this ask was ever made. This letter about the phone bill was never mailed. It was found in Sheila's apartment and had never been sent. It's thus unclear how it was legally relevant, and even less clear now how it could have contributed to any motive for John to want to harm Sheila.
That then left the state with one last line of attack. That this was a case of right place, wrong time, but a different type than the one mentioned in the introduction. Instead, according to the state, John Brookins could not return to Sheila's place shortly after 6 o'clock p.m. to find Sharon murdering her mom, because Sheila wouldn't be killed until several hours later. To support this theory, the state called three key witnesses at trial. The first was George Wilson, the bouncer at the ballpark tavern down the road from Sheila's apartment complex, where Sharon used to turn tricks. Wilson would testify at trial that he saw Sharon at the ballpark tavern between 9 and 11 p.m. on Thursday, December 20th. According to Wilson, Sharon asked him for $5, which he said he didn't have. Sharon then had Wilson call someone, with Wilson dialing the number, hearing a woman with a British accent, and handing the phone to Sharon, who unsuccessfully asked the woman if she could borrow money. Of course, if Wilson's testimony is accurate, it's virtually certain she was speaking to her Anglophile mother, meaning that Sheila Ginsberg was still alive 3 to 5 hours after John Brookins had said he'd seen her being murdered. But can we take Wilson's testimony on faith? Probably not.
Wilson was interviewed at least twice before trial. In one interview, he said that this encounter with Sharon occurred at 6 p.m. on Friday, December 21st, with Sharon returning that same night to say her mother had been murdered. And while the medical evidence is consistent with Sheila being murdered early or late on the evening of Thursday, December 20th, it is absolutely inconsistent with her being killed at or after 6 p.m. on Friday, the 21st. In another interview, and again at trial, Wilson would say that after his phone call encounter with Sharon, that he didn't see her at the ballpark tavern the next day, despite the fact that he was working, but that he did see her 2 days later. At trial, Wilson thus places the first encounter on Thursday and the second encounter on Saturday. But there's a problem with this. Sharon was at the ballpark tavern on Friday, multiple times, according to different witnesses. So if George Wilson is right about his one point of consistency, that he saw Sharon and then saw her again 2 days later, could that mean that Sharon and George Wilson called her mother on Wednesday night, followed by him seeing her again on Friday night? It's unclear, and it's also unclear whether Sheila was even calling her mother. While George Wilson testified that he dialed the number in his initial police interview, he said that he gave the phone to Sharon to make the call, and he makes no mention of hearing the person on the other end of the call. When pressed by defense counsel at trial, George Wilson said that the fact that he dialed the number and spoke to the other person came to him the night before his testimony, about a year and a half later. All of which goes to say that George Wilson can't really tell us much about when Sheila Ginsberg was last alive. But if we believe that Sharon did make a call to her mother at 6 p.m., the time initially given by Wilson, and that the call was on Thursday because it couldn't have been on Friday, well, that would be very interesting for reasons we'll discuss later.
Next, we have a second person of interest called by the prosecution, and this was a literal person of interest. His name is Roy Jennings, and he was a friend of Sheila's who lived in the same apartment complex. Roy Jennings would testify at trial that Sheila had called him at about 9:30 on Thursday, December 20th, 1990, with the two of them talking about going shopping at Fort Dix the next day. Roy says that Sheila told him that she'd be up to visit with him after taking a bath, but then Sheila never came over. So Roy called her at about 11 p.m. with no response, and Roy assumed that Sheila had too much to drink and had gone to bed. Finally, Roy says, he called Sheila the next morning at 9 a.m. and got no response, leading him to believe that Sheila had slept in, a sleep that Roy didn't want to disturb. Once again, if Roy is being accurate here, it means that Sheila was alive until at least 9:30 p.m. on Thursday, December 20th, blowing John Brookins' timeline out by about 3.5 hours. But again, there are reasons to doubt this testimony. First, there's the first newspaper story about this case. It's in the Courier Journal by reporter Adam Bell, who spoke to Roy Jennings for the piece. And it states that Roy's calls to Sheila, quote, went unanswered Thursday night at around 9:30 and 11 and Friday morning at 9. In other words, if Bell's article is right, Roy did not speak to Sheila at 9:30 p.m. on Thursday, December 20th. Meaning that he either never made contact with her on Thursday or had spoken with her earlier in the day. Second, Detective Sam Wisniewski was the first police officer to interview Roy Jennings on the night Sheila's body was found. The notes from the interview don't mention a 9:30 p.m. phone call, but do mention appointments that Roy Jennings apparently had with Sheila Ginsberg at 11 p.m. on December 20th and 9 a.m. on December 21st. But the notes then say that Roy Jennings denied making either appointment. Obviously, a plain reading of those notes would mean that Roy Jennings didn't actually make either appointment, although the detective would testify at trial that he thought Roy simply meant that he didn't attend either appointment. But who knows? As noted above, Roy was a person of interest in the case. Sheila's body was discovered by her son Barry after he arrived from Florida at about 7:15 on Friday, December 21st. Unable to process what he'd seen, Barry ran upstairs to the apartment above his mother's, which was occupied by Paul Davis and his wife Mary. Paul came down to see the crime scene while Mary got to see the aftermath, including what happened to Roy Jennings.
Oh my gosh. They took him into tech. He had made spaghetti sauce for dinner, and there were splatters on his shoes. Oh my gosh, I'll never forget when they were taking him out. I instinctively took a step back out of fear.
Roy Jennings was a serious enough suspect that he was given a polygraph test asking him questions about whether he had murdered Sheila Ginsburg and whether he'd been in her apartment on Thursday, December 20th. Roy's responses to both questions indicated that he was being deceptive, meaning he had flunked the lie detector. This isn't to say that Roy Jennings killed Sheila Ginsburg. After all, polygraphs are junk science. But it's to say that Roy Jennings was a suspect, knew he was a suspect, and was under a great deal of stress, which is what polygraphs test for. So it's not much of a stretch to believe that Roy Jennings would have given multiple accountings of what he did and didn't do with Sheila, meaning that it's tough to give any one version much credibility.
The third and final witness whom the state called to push back the time of Sheila's death was Margaret Albright, an elderly woman who lived in the same apartment complex as Sheila Ginsburg, but in a unit that was across the parking lot. In a police interview, Margaret would state that she sat down to watch the news at 11 o'clock p.m. on Thursday, December 20th, when she heard a voice that sounded like a woman being attacked, with the woman saying, "No, no, please, I said no." Then, about a half hour later, after the news ended at 11:35 p.m., Margaret went to her bedroom and heard the same female voice saying, quote, "Please, somebody help. He's killing me. He's stabbing me. Please, somebody help." In the police interview, Margaret would say that she didn't think much of it at the time because she often heard people yelling in the parking lot. But by the time trial rolled around, she was convinced that the screaming was coming from Sheila's apartment. And if she's right, it both busts John Brookins' timeline and refutes the notion that Sharon could have murdered her mom. Remember that Girl Scout that John Brookins married? Her name is Karen, and she did some field work that could have earned her a criminal investigation badge.
They go to her and talk to her, and now she says this to them, which is a year and a half later. She never called the police, and it's December, and you can't hear. This is the thing. She lived in that other part of the building where Chevelle lived, the same building on that same side as Chevelle. She may have even been, I don't know if she was on the same floor as Chevelle, but she was on that very same side and a floor up. She was on the second floor.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's also a firewall in between. I took pictures of this place and went in and out of it myself. You couldn't hear someone from Sheila's apartment to that apartment, first of all. Second of all, Sheila, her throat was slit or cut or whatever. And we never saw autopsy reports, but when you read the trial transcripts, and Mr. McAllis, who's the medical examiner, explains that, I think that there was not, she died quickly.
Right. Karen is often one fact. Sheila's throat was not slit, but her hyoid bone was fractured from strangulation. But Karen is right about the gist of the testimony by the medical examiner. He testified that, quote, "I believe Sheila became unconscious very quickly." He based this on a number of factors, including the lack of defensive wounds or even any injuries to her hands or forearms, no downward drip marks from the blood, and the direction of the stab wounds, indicating that Sheila had likely been knocked down and unconscious when being struck with the scissors. According to the medical examiner, strangulation and blunt force trauma to the head, likely from the trophy base, rendered Sheila unconscious long before she was stabbed. In other words, if Margaret Albright heard Sheila Ginsburg screaming at around 11 p.m., there's no way she later heard her screaming half an hour later, and there's absolutely no way she heard her screaming about being stabbed. Sheila had been knocked unconscious quickly before the scissors ever entered her body.
There's also another problem for Margaret's testimony, and that's Mary, who, as noted before, lived directly above Sheila. The Lakeview Manor apartments didn't have much in the way of soundproofing, and so Mary could often hear Sheila's TV below her.
I could usually hear the TV through the ceiling, or my floor.
Mary was home on the night of Thursday, December 20th, and heard nothing below her in the 11 o'clock hour. Indeed, either at or soon after the time that Margaret said she heard Sheila screaming, Mary went down to do a load of laundry in the room located next to Sheila's unit, and again, didn't hear anything, although she did get an uneasy feeling.
I was doing laundry at the time. I'm a night person, and I had been going up and down the stairs, and I just got a creepy feeling. I have goosebumps right now. I can't explain it, but I didn't want to go back downstairs to the laundry room, not one more time. I woke my husband up. I said, I don't care if you have clean shirts, thermals, whatever. I'm sorry. I said, I'm getting, for some reason, my gut instinct is telling me not to go downstairs anymore. I never heard anything.
So if Mary didn't hear anything while directly above and then next to Sheila's unit, how did Margaret Albright hear her screaming bloody murder? The answer is that she likely didn't. On the other hand, it's quite possible that someone else doing their laundry earlier that day did hear the murder of Sheila Ginsburg.
And I heard someone yell, you know, a female yelling, give me the money, give me the money. And it was this tussle, and I heard this thump, thump.
Next time on Undisclosed.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. As always, I'd like to thank our sponsors. You can support us at patreon.com/undisclosedpod, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.